The Local Administration and Veteran Affairs Subcommittee will come to order. Victoria, please call the roll. Members, please remember to speak into your microphones.
Chair Toledo?
Here.
Vice Chair Smith?
Here.
Democratic Ranking Member Goff Marcy?
Here.
Barnaby?
Here.
Bartleman? Benjamin?
Here.
Daly?
Here.
DeSegley?
Here.
Gia Lombardo?
Here.
Harding? Joseph?
In the house.
Malo?
Here.
Overdorf?
Yes, ma'am.
Persons Mulica?
Here.
Sabatini?
Here.
Salzman?
Here.
Snyder?
Here.
Woodson?
Here, thank you.
Thank you, members, and by your presence, we have a quorum. Before we begin, I want to remind you all that the House has implemented procedures designed to make our meetings safer during this present time. I would also ask for everyone to please silence your electronic devices. Members, today we have one bill to consider, followed by two presentations. We will now take up House Bill 59 by Representative McLean related to growth management. Representative McLean, you are recognized to explain your bill. I don't hear you.
That on?
Oh.
Yeah, okay. It's on. Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair, Ranking Member, Vice Chair Smith, and Ranking Member Goff Marcel for allowing me to present my bill this morning. This House Bill 59. I was involved in local government for 12 years as a county commissioner, and one of the things I realized when I was on the county commission is that while property rights are spoken to in the Constitution of Florida, and it says that it's, you know, a prominent piece of what should be, what should take place when we're making decisions, one of the things I found out is that we also have a comp plan and it has elements to it. And anytime that you're given a primer as a new commissioner, when you're given a primer on comp plan changes that you're going to make, there's all these other elements listed, and kind of property rights are just kind of hanging out there, and that they're in the Constitution. And so one of the things that I wanted to do for a long time is to be able to actually list the property rights so that they would be part of the comp plan. So that this bill will take care of that. Also, the bill requires the DOT, when they decide to sell a piece of property that they've acquired through eminent domain, that they would go to the prior property owner and allow them right of first refusal. The bill provides the proposed changes to a development agreement, do not require consent by property owners not affected by those changes. The bill would prohibit one municipality from annexing land within the boundaries of another municipality without the latter's consent. The bill authorizes amending certain development of regional impact agreements using procedures adopted by local governments to amend or change the development orders. That is the bill, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative. And I believe there's an amendment to the bill.
There is.
You are recognized to explain the amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The amendment would remove the requirement of the bill would change the currently the comprehensive plan of each municipality established after January 1st. It's 2019. We're going to roll that back to 2016 because there are some requirements that didn't meet the 2019. So we're rolling that back, and then it would remove the provision concerning municipal annexation. That's the amendment.
Thank you, members. Are there any questions on the amendment? Okay, we received no public comments on the amendment. Members, we are now in debate. Is there any debate on the amendment? See none. Rep. McLean, you are recognized to close on your amendment.
Wave close.
Members, without objection, show the amendment is adopted. Members, we are now back on the bill as amended. Are there any questions on the bill as amended? Yes, Representative Daly.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And Representative, I know you've been working on this for several years, and I really appreciate the work and effort you've put in. I think you also know I kind of wear two hats, right? I came from local government. I tend to be a huge supporter of home rule, but I also have work in my day job as a developer. And so I can see both sides of the argument. I do appreciate the way that you've kind of thread the needle. I guess from the city perspective, I did want to ask, part of my concern is if this is going to be a substantial cost impact to these cities, if they all have to come in and amend their plans right out the gate or about by the date that you've provided in the bill, rather. Is there any possibility that you would consider an amendment to kind of move the deadline to kind of coincide with, as you know, and maybe for the benefit of the members, cities and counties are required to review their plans every 7 years. So is there a way to work that in so they can do it as part of that 7-year review and update?
Madam Chair.
Rep. McLean, you're recognized.
Thank you. Representative Daly, thank you for that, those comments. I did get a report from the League of Cities. They sent over some information to me if I've compiled it properly, and I haven't had a chance to reach out to them to make sure I have. But currently, the date would be 2024. And if in that period, about 65% of the municipalities would have to update their plans anyway. So we've got, however, it would leave about 43 municipalities that would be left outside of that window. I'm willing to have a conversation and, again, make sure that the information been compiled properly. If it has, we could probably extend it back maybe a year or two, and it looks like to me it would capture everybody at that point anyway. I would rather not go the full 7 years, but I think if we can capture a fair amount of the municipalities, I'd be in favor. You know, I'd be willing to look at that. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Bartleman, you had...
Yes, I have two questions. I just want to preface my question to say that a lot of my district includes master plan communities. And 26 years ago when I bought my home, I expected my community to look a certain way because that's why I bought there. And those communities exist across the state. So what you're saying is you want to take away a municipality's ability to regulate their zoning requirements, for instance, what signs go on commercial property, what are the landscaping requirements, because this bill does that. So is that something you're looking to do, or am I reading it wrong? Can you explain that to me?
You're recognized.
Sure, thank you. No, ma'am, what it would allow is for, if there was a DRI, which is, you know, impact, regional impact, it only allows the local government to make certain changes to that regional impact. It doesn't preclude any design criteria, anything like that, that would, you know, that local government would want to implement.
Follow up?
Okay, yeah. All right, so let me ask it. It does give the property owner the rights to change things. So if you read it, let me ask the second question, then maybe that will help. So this bill states that private property rights must allow for the right to privacy to exclude others from the property to protect owners' possessions. So in my community, if my neighbor wanted to build a 10-foot wall with razor wire around it, this bill would protect them to do that. But then what about the aesthetics of my community and the master plan of my community? That's what the language specifically states.
You're recognized.
Thank you. Representative Bartleman, thank you for your questions. And I apologize, I did try to get with you yesterday.
I did call you back.
Okay. You tried to call me back. It's all good.
I did.
No, thank you. And we could have had this conversation then. But so we're talking, this is at the comprehensive plan stage where this would come before the county commission in a comprehensive plan. So you have to remember there's two pieces. There's zoning and there's comprehensive plans. Mm-hmm. This only has to do with the comprehensive plan. If the property was deemed to be by the local municipality or government, if it was deemed to be the proper change to the comp plan, that could be done. The zoning issue would take place at some future time, although most, in my experience on local government, there was a time when we mixed zoning and comprehensive plans together in the same hearing, and so you would then be able to lay out this. Really, what we're trying to do here is just say, look, a property owner that has a piece of property next door to another piece of property, they have certain rights. And a person who owns a piece of property has a certain right to sell that property or dispose of it or do certain things. But if I bought a piece of property in a community, there's deed restrictions in there. I know that. This does not remove deed restrictions. This doesn't remove deed restrictions.
Okay.
This is only at the comprehensive planning stage when the individual comes in and wants to change a piece of property that's in the current comp plan.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Do you have a follow-up?
I appreciate it.
Thank you. Representative Smith, you're recognized.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Rep, for the good bill. As we've discussed previously, last year and then since SB 410, I share your respect for property rights. In an overabundance of caution, as we've discussed before, because in Seminole County and in my district, Seminole County has a rural boundary. It was passed by voters in order to limit growth in areas due to ecologically sensitive areas. As I read this, I'm just hoping to have your assurance that as we do our due diligence at the local and county level, that you'd be willing to amend or be willing to discuss potential changes because, that's my question. However, I will just be clear. I'm up on your bill today, but I will fight this bill tooth and nail if it poses any clear and present danger to the rural nature of my district. But I hope you will be open to amending it if lawyers give proper guidance to me and that you'll be discussing that. Thank you.
Recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Smith, thank you for that. And obviously, I know what your concern was. Obviously, it was a piece of the bill that has been removed because of that concern, and so that piece is already out of the bill. Obviously, if you come, if there's some other issue, then certainly we have that conversation. Thank you.
Representative Benjamin, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for presenting this bill for us for our consideration. And I'm insensitive to property rights. I'm a property owner. So I understand our country was built on property rights. So I understand that. I also understand that we have home charter rules as well. And I'm a political scientist. And so I was taught that government closest to the people is best for the people. And in this bill, and I typically don't try to have duplicitous laws for protections that are already held within the law. And so if you can explain to me, how does the Florida Constitution and the Burt Harris Act not already cover your concerns?
You're recognized.
So as it relates to the property rights issue, my concern is when local governments, and so I served with, during my tenure, I have 12 years on the county commission, I served with 8 or 10 different county commissioners. When we would have a primer, when new commissioners would come in, we would sit down with staff, they would give us a primer on comprehensive land use plans, how we're supposed to determine them, the things that we're supposed to consider. This would add, it's in the Constitution. I know all of you in here know the Florida Constitution by heart, and you keep a copy in your top pocket and all that stuff. And so, but most folks don't do that. And so what you have is it gets lost, that property rights are paramount. That, in other words, the property right is paramount to everything else that's in the, that should be considered in the comp plan. This just adds and says, hey, here's some things you also need to consider when you're considering comp plan change. And it is that property rights are paramount to our individual rights.
You're recognized for a follow-up.
So I hear that you were on the city council.
County Commission.
And so it makes me question, is this change, this statute that we want to create, is this a reaction to a very localized issue such that maybe it's not good for the entire state, but just a particular portion of it?
You're recognized.
I believe that property rights are one of the most important rights that we have as individuals, and it's one of the greatest economic drivers for the middle class in America, that we can own property, that we can sell property, and that we can use it as we see fit as it relates within some confine of your neighbor. And so it's not local. This is something that I experienced in my time on the county commission with different commissioners, not having a real understanding of that the property rights come first, and then you consider these other things as well.
Thank you. Representative Woodson, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Rep. McCann, for the presentation of this bill. My question to you, I am a supporter of home rule, tell you the truth, because they know the community better than anybody else. And what I'm asking you, can you limit the bill to the requirements that local government could include property rights to the comprehensive plan that you have, as opposed to dictating really what should be in there?
You're recognized.
I believe, so this bill does not limit local property, that does not limit local governments, the municipalities, it doesn't limit them from carrying out. Someone mentioned the Representative Smith mentioned the boundary line. Marion County, we actually have a farm preservation area. It's 165,000 acres. We have a farmland preservation area in Marion County. We've protected that over a period of time as commissioners. We've protected that over a period of time. We put certain rules and restrictions in there whenever someone would bring a land use. So this does not in any way restrict local governments from making decisions about their own comprehensive plans. It merely says when you as an individual commissioner or city council person, whatever it might be, when you're making those decisions, please understand here's some things that you need to think about as it relates to a property right of the individual owner.
Thank you. Do you have a follow-up, Representative Woodson?
I think we just need to look at it a little bit closer to make sure that that's included in the bill, that they have the right to really put in whatever, to do whatever is good for that, because what goes for Marion County might not be good for, let's just say, Florida, you know.
Do you have a follow-up question, Representative?
Yes, thank you, Madam.
Representative Joseph?
Thank you, Madam Chair. So my question for you, so I also have a background in local government, but from the staff side, as an attorney advising local municipalities all around the state about compliance and those kinds of issues. And I really kind of wanted to dovetail on one of the questions raised by Representative Daley about the timing. Because as you're aware, right now, every 7 years, they already have to go through the comprehensive plan process, right? You've served on local government as a county commissioner, and that process is intense and a lot of sometimes drama, but more my concern is the cost associated with it, right? So I understand where you're trying to go with it, but I really want to impress upon you just the practicality of making it coincide with that every 7 years, as opposed to forcing this, what could be seen as an unfunded mandate on the local governments, because, you know, it's a tight budget year for us at the state level, but it's even worse at the local level, right? So I really want to highlight that, and I know you haven't looked at whatever materials he referenced. I don't know those materials. I'm just looking at this from a process standpoint for the local governments, because, you know, I'm not opposed to the idea of the bill, the concept of the bill. I just don't want you to have this unintended negative consequence, even though 70-something odd counties, it's fine, but what about the other 40-something, some of which are represented by folks here on both sides of the aisle.
Is there a question, or do you want to save this for debate?
The question is, Madam Chair, would you consider just changing it so that it coincides with the 7-year time period that they automatically have to do it? I know it's less than the 24 that you have there, but, I mean, it would just make sense.
You're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So here's part of the challenge. I've asked the League of Cities numerous times, to provide information to me to what the cost would be. This is 5 sessions I've run this bill. I've never gotten that information. I do know that in my local government, which we're non-charter, it's a non-charter county where I come from, this would be, you, in the old days when there was, when DCA was around, you could only do comp plan changes twice a year. You could only do them twice a year. Now you can do a comp plan change anytime you want to. So someone needs to gather some information and tell me what the burden is. I know that there was some analysis done. It was done by the Senate staff several years ago, and they now have retracted that they're not sure what the cost is. And so it's difficult for me to say it's okay to stretch this thing out further based on a cost that no one has told, can prove or says that here's the number. So that's the difficulty for me personally. I've already said I'm willing to take a look at it. And so somebody give me some information and I'll certainly, if you can show me where there's a huge fiscal impact, then yeah, I'll be glad to have that conversation.
Thank you. Ranking member?
Oh, I had a follow-up question, Madam Chair.
Excuse me, sorry. You were recognized.
Thank you. You mentioned the Senate report that had some figures previously, which you said they've since retracted. What did those figures indicate?
Madam Chair.
And what was the basis for the retraction?
You're recognized.
It was $2 million. It was over $2 million, I think, if I remember. But that's been four or five sessions back. We went to them. We asked them. We said, where did you come up with this information from? They said it was merely an estimate that they had tried to put together. And then, so...
Okay.
Care, how much history can I give you?
Okay, no, that's fine. Last follow-up question.
So again, back four or five, back when I first ran this bill, that was the original, one of the original challenges with it. And then we went back to them, had a conversation. We said, somebody tell us where this came from. They said, well, it was merely an estimation. Since then, I've asked for refined information from the League of Cities, and I have not gotten it.
All right.
And just as a reminder, this is the first stop of three.
Yeah, sure. I know. I just want to make sure.
One additional follow-up?
Yeah, the last additional follow-up I have for you is, so if the numbers do come back, I haven't spoken to the League of Cities, so I understand you've made that request. That's not my burden. To me, that's your burden as the bill sponsor to find whatever information you can to present to us as the members. My question for you is, if the numbers do come back circa the $2 million range, how does that change your analysis of the bill?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, A, I don't think it's going to come back, but B, it only changes the fact, again, 65%, if I understand the information that was sent, 65% of the municipalities will have already had to have done this. So that leaves 35% that haven't. So, I think we keep going back and forth over the fiscal analysis, and even, yeah, I'm just, somebody has to tell me why, because I've been involved. I went through two EAR processes when I was on the county commission. It is staff time that they have to take. There are some costs as it relates to some advertising and those kinds of things. But I don't know. It's indeterminate. So,
thank you. This is certainly speculative. So we need the numbers to provide accurate data. Ranking member, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have the same background as you with serving on the council for two terms, and I didn't see a problem with property rights in my experience. Could you give me concrete examples of comprehensive plan of local government infringing upon constitutional property rights?
You're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yeah, so a property owner would want to sell a piece of property. The surrounding property owners would then come into your public hearing. When you're having a public hearing, you're going to do a comprehensive land use change. The landscape of that part of your county or municipality has changed greatly. Obviously, we can, look at Davie, Florida. 20 years ago, Davie was mainly a dairy farm, right? Today, Davie, Florida is a metropolis almost. And so things change, properties change, and those are the decisions that local government's left to make. Those are the decisions that come before us. Has the county in this area changed that this piece of property should no longer be agriculture, or it should no longer be for industrial? I've had places where industrial properties want to change from industry to residential, or vice versa. And so you had it. Unless you were to master plan if we'd been allowed to master plan the entire in Florida from day one, it would look much different than it does today. However, people move to different places, and there are comprehensive plans that take place. But the property owner who's wanting to change the plan of his property should not necessarily. It shouldn't be the major. It shouldn't be the only driver for the people making decisions. These other elements that are in the comp plan, because that person still has rights, and property rights are tantamount to our freedom.
Any follow-up? Representative Woodson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Ms. Webmarkin, I just want to follow up on the previous question that I asked you. I just need some clarification on it. relating to the question that I had asked, is stipulated in the bill, if a local government adopts its own property rights element, the element may not conflict with the statement of rights provided in subparagraph one. And this is what I was talking about, referring to dictating what should be in there. If you can remove that clause, then that would give them the flexibility of coming up with their own right as they know better their community.
You're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Madam Chair, I guess, I'm sorry, Representative Woodson, you're going to have to reframe that question for me because we're not infringing on the right of the local municipalities or governments to make their own decisions as it relates to the comprehensive planning of that community. There is no infringement.
Right, and I understand that. Well, I'm sorry, Madam Chair, can I go?
You're right.
I understand that, but it states right here in the bill, it may not conflict with the statement of rights that you have in subparagraph one. That's all I'm saying. I just want to make sure that's not included to give them the flexibility of coming up with what they see fit for the community. That's what I'm saying.
And I'm sure Rep. McLean will meet with you to go through that and see if their adjustments can be made. Representative Benjamin, you're recognized.
Madam Chair, if I just could provide maybe some clarity in the way of a question. Because I understand Rep. Woodson's issue is that the statement that they want to place in the comprehensive plan cannot be then infringed upon later. But my question is, because property rights are already protected in our Florida Constitution, if a plan, in fact, violated a property owner's rights, that plan would already be invalid, wouldn't it?
You're recognized.
Madam Chair. Not necessarily. I mean, that's why you would end up with a Burt Harris Act, right? Or that's why you might end up with if you went to court of law, there's a possibility that the court of law would say, hey, this is not an infringement. I mean, I think there's been numerous, let me just say this. In my time on the county commission, I sat in on, my first year on the county commission was 2004, we had 64 comprehensive land use changes that came before the county commission. So my experience, I think, is pretty well documented from a perspective of I've been in a lot of these land hearings, these comprehensive plan use. And all we're trying to do is say, you must consider these things. The other elements, there's nothing concrete about any of those elements because you could actually be challenged on any of those elements. If as a local government, if you made a comprehensive plan change, someone could challenge you on any of those elements if you made a decision that they felt was unfair or unreasonable. And this is just another one of those.
Madam Chair, may I respond?
One follow-up, please.
So if they're only elements that can be challenged upon a presentation, then the language in your bill is not necessary that we not infringe upon them or not conflict with them because they're simply elements among other elements that should but not shall be required.
I think you can save that for debate. Any other questions? Okay, we had two public comments on the bill. We have one from Diego Echeverry, who waves in support. He is with the Americans for Prosperity. And we have Edward Briggs, representing Highland Homes, who also waves in support. Members, we are now in debate. Is there any debate on the bill as amended? Yes, Representative Sabatini, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you once again, Representative McLean, for filing one of the most important bills ever filed in the history of the Florida legislature. I mean that quite literally, and I'm proud to be a co-sponsor of this bill. It's about time someone speaks up for property rights around here and not just acts the skeptic. This is a very important bill. Why? Because property rights have been under attack in this country for about 100 years. They've been degraded to almost secondary rights. With the decline of the Lochner era in the history of the Supreme Court, property rights became something different than what the founding fathers imagined. Originally, they were supposed to be equal to any right in the Bill of Rights, supposed to be a fundamental right. Our founding fathers spoke up very affirmatively for property rights. Arthur Lee, one of the delegates to the Constitutional Convention, said, property rights are the guardian of every other right. The guardian of every other right. That's what he said about property rights. It's the thing in which protects all of our other rights. James Madison said, a man is said to have a right in his property as he is equally said to have a property in his rights. When you get rid of property rights, you get rid of all of your rights. We need to step up as a legislature to protect rights. The courts have not done so. Since the end of the Lochner era, there has been a failure of courts to protect our property rights. So it's to the state legislatures now to protect them. This is a small and modest attempt to reassert the importance of property rights for Floridians and Americans. Florida is now the beacon of freedom in this country. We are the envy of the country. The whole country is looking at us. They call us the land of the free. I always thought it was going to end up being Texas. We're actually number one. We are the freest state at this point. This is another good demonstration, this bill, of why we have deserved that title. The goal with this bill, as all bills related to property rights should be, to treat regulations on property, similar to the way we would treat a physical seizure. If I came and took your car, you would say that was an infringement of your property rights. But if I lay down regulation after regulation after regulation, limiting what it is you can do with your property, that would also be a bit of a seizure. But the public has lost sight of how important that restriction is and how significant that restriction is. And so it's up to us to try to fix that, and that's the duty of the state legislatures. Once again, thank you for the bill, Representative McLean.
Thank you. Representative Daly, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I won't be going through a con law lecture, but I do, Representative, I just wanted to mention, I appreciate your willingness to work with us on this bill. I was able to be supportive of the bill last year. And it's at its final stop, actually, on the floor. I can't get there today, but I think if we can continue to work together, work on the language we discussed, so that it can have as minimal of an impact fiscally on our cities, I hope to get there in the future. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Bartleman.
Yes.
Recognized.
Yes. Thank you so much for answering my questions and the debate here today. And for me, this is an issue. When I reached out to my local mayor, municipalities. I understand the need for property rights, but there also has to be a balance. One of my municipalities is a planned community, Weston. Another one is a rural community, Southwest Ranches. And they each, and Davie, which you spoke of, I've been communicating with Sue Starkey, the council member, and Davie as well. And people move into their communities. When people move to Southwest Ranches, they are there because there are not a lot of rules. They can do what they can do what they want to their property. Their horses, there's everything imaginable. When people moved to Weston, they moved into a master plan community with a certain expectation to maintain their property values. And with almost every community has an individual homeowners association as well. So for me, representing these two very different communities, it makes sense for me to preserve home rule for those communities. So because of that, I cannot support the bill, but I have to go back to these communities and back to my constituents. And also, I'm concerned about the Florida League of Cities issues, but I really appreciate what you're trying to do here and respect that, but I have to go home to my constituents and represent them. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Benjamin, you are recognized.
Just, again, thank you for being here. Thank you for going with me in debates. But I'm back on the fact that we already have protections under law. You heard Representative Sabatini told you that we're in one of the freest states in the union. That includes with regards to our already held property rights that we have within our Constitution. Florida has already made it clear that property rights are sanctimonious in Florida. Laws should fix something. This law fixes nothing. We have one of the best property rights protections in our Constitution within the Union. There is no need to get duplicitous in the law for one particular area.
This law is not good for all of Florida. It will handicap some areas, while it may only limit, potentially help another. And for that reason, I can't today vote in support of this particular bill. But hopefully, we can work, and if there is a change needed, we can work to make a change. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Harding, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Chair McClain, thanks for presenting. Thanks for your perseverance. I think it's a good reminder for all of us young members, the time and dedication and perseverance that on an issue that's so important and fundamental as this, that it takes. And I don't think, frankly, I don't think anyone understands this issue better than, has a better perspective of this than you, and having the local experience, but also understanding the fundamental right we have to protect property rights. So proud to support the bill today, and thanks again.
Ranking member, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you for your willingness to answer all our questions. And it seems like you're willing to also try to make the bill better as it goes along. But I still can't get behind it because of the home rule aspect of it. And the example you gave to me further made me not be able to support this bill, because you were saying that someone wants to do something to their property, and then there's a hearing, and other people come in, and they have a problem with it. And I think that's what local government is about, being able to come in and voice your opinion and get a community that everyone can get behind. And that's, it works best at the local level, not the state level. So I can't support your bill today.
Thank you. Representative Woodson, you're recognized.
Thank you very much, Madam Chair. And thank you so much, Chair McClain, for really shedding some lights for us on the bill. It's very important, as you can see, to all of us. However, we have to work together in order to meet each other halfway to make sure that when we go back, we can look at the people who elected us in the state of Florida to serve, we can look at them in the face and say we did right. So we are willing to work with you. However, today I cannot support it in light of what the question that I raised to you. But thank you so much for your work on that.
Thank you. Rep. Salzman, you're recognized.
I promised my constituents back home that I would voice my support of this bill in every step of the way, because this is something that, at least in the panhandle, is so strongly needed. So I just wanted to make sure that I went on record that Escambia County is really excited to see this bill, and I'll be supporting it.
Thank you. Representative Overdorf.
Thank you, Chair. I want to say thank you very much for bringing this bill forward. We'll be supporting this bill today. Also wanted to point out to many of the members who have said that they're willing to work with you, they're willing to make this bill better, and in order for that to happen, there needs to be affirmative action today. And so for all of my other members here that have said that, you know, you're a member that works with others, you're a member that listens, and you're a member that brings forward legislation that also has the workings of all the people in this room that have concerns, I would urge those folks to vote yes today, and then test you on your promise and look at that how you work towards that. So I look forward to supporting the bill, and I hope that many others in here hearing this testimony and this closing from myself will, in fact, possibly change their votes from a no to a yes, and I look forward to working with you. Thank you.
Thank you. No other debate. Rep. McClain, you are recognized to close on your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, thank you for your questions, for your concern for your own communities. I think that's, you know, why we're here. I do think that we've somehow gotten lost in the conversation here a little bit about the home rule question. This in no way limits any local municipality, city council, county commission from continuing to make decisions on land use changes. It does not limit them. That, in fact, it's one of the few things in local government, and I've said this over the years, that actually local government still has most of the authority as it relates to land use changes. So it is protected somewhat. However, there are times when local governments do not consider the property rights of everyone involved. And that's all we're trying to spell out here is please understand everyone has a right. And so I think that's what we're trying to point out. Again, I appreciate your conversations. Look forward to speaking with you all as we move through the process. And Madam Chair, thank you for allowing me to present today.
Thank you. Rep. McLean having closed, Victoria, please call roll on the bill as amended.
Chair Toledo?
Yes.
Representatives Barnaby?
Yes.
Bartleman?
No.
Benjamin?
No.
Daly?
No.
DeSegli?
Yes.
Gia Lombardo?
Yes.
Goff Marcil?
No.
Harding?
Yes.
Joseph?
No.
Malo?
Yes.
Overdorf?
Yes, ma'am.
Persons Mulliga?
Yes.
Sabatini?
Yes.
Salzman?
Yes.
Snyder?
Yes.
Smith?
Yes.
Woodson?
No.
By your vote, House Bill 59 is reported favorably. Congratulations, Rep.
McLean. Madam Chair, thank you, members.
Next, members, we have two exciting presentations. With us today is Amy Baker, the coordinator of the Office of Economic and Demographic Research. Among the great number of useful reports published annually by the EDR is the Local Government Financial Information Handbook, an exhaustive compilation of information about the many revenue sources available to fund local governments. Coordinator Baker will present an introduction to revenue resources for local governments, and after her presentation, if time allows, I will open the meeting for questions. Coordinator Baker, you are recognized.
Okay, thank you, Madam Chairman. We're going to go through kind of a high-level overview of local government revenue sources. And the first thing that's worth noting is that the array of revenue sources available to them is quite large. We normally only think of a couple of them. They stand out. But if you delve through everything that's available to them, even in these revenue categories that we're showing here, you can see it's a broad array. So this data is actually pulled from fiscal year 2018-19 from the local government's annual revenue reports that they submit to the chief financial officer. And so what we're showing here is a set of numbers for the counties, a set of numbers for the municipalities. And then of all the revenue sources they reported collectively, how did it break out among these categories? This data is not 100% complete, but very close to being complete. For the counties, the only county that we're missing is Dixie. And on the city side, we're only missing about 18 municipalities. So the percentages are pretty well locked at this point, although the dollar numbers may change just very slightly. You can see when you look at the array, the number one source available to both counties and cities is charges for services. And the charges for services category is very broad. They include everything from water, wastewater, natural gas, electricity, mass transit, garbage collection, recreation, building inspection fees, public transportation, and the list continues even from there. That's just the most important ones. So it is not one revenue source, but a wide variety of different things that are collapsed together with the same thought. The common element across them is it's considered charges based on either on a direct or in measurable voluntary consumption of a provided good or service. Looking over to the municipality side, it is also their number one source. So they don't match in terms of percentages. It's about 29.4% of all revenues that have come into the counties and about 34.8% for all revenues coming into municipalities, but number one for both. As you move through the list, they start diverging some. So you can see if you go to the opposite extreme, what's the least important to them, that's actually two different things. For the counties, it's the insurance premium and other general taxes authorized by law for them. And for the cities, it's actually the local business tax is their least important source. After you get out of the top three or four, there's a pretty large drop-off. So those are by far and away the most important to them. Moving to the next display, it's the same data, but I've broken it up a little bit differently. Here, we've taken the population and we've turned those total collections into per capita numbers. There's a little bit of a hesitation about thinking about this too much, only because the counties and the cities are so diverse. There, if you did a profile of where they draw their revenues from, they are very diverse among the 67 counties or the 411 municipal governments. And we'll talk more about that in a moment. But it does give you an idea of the relative magnitude of what they're charging their residents for different things and how they rank against each other. Strictly speaking, it's not a measure of tax burden. We normally think of tax burden as being against revenues being against income. So you would have to do a different analysis where each local government, you're looking at their income data. It's also worth noting here, you can sort of scale them against each other because our population in Florida is pretty evenly split. We use for this analysis because it's 18-19 data, the April 1st, 2019 population, and you can see it was 50.6% incorporated, 49.4% unincorporated. I would tell you normally when we do these sorts of analysis, we treat Jacksonville Duval separately and distinctly because it's a consolidated government. So it has elements of being both a city and a county. So we usually treat it outside of this. So that is how they're collecting today. The next question is, under what authority are they doing that? How do they have the ability to collect these revenues? So generally, the ability of local governments to raise revenue for their operations is seated in the state constitution. And among the things that the state constitution sets out is a specific allowance for them to collect ad valorem taxation. And if you remember on the previous slide that we looked at, ad valorem taxes are actually the second most important source, single source, it is only ad valorem, that's available to county governments and municipalities in Florida. So ad valorem taxes make up about 24% of the revenue for our counties and about 14.7% of the revenues for our county or for our cities. And what's important about that is it is their most flexible source of revenue. You can think of our general revenue fund at the state level, and ad valorem sort of serves the same purpose. If you were drilling down even further, their ad valorem to availability to local government is about the same, actually, in terms of percentage as our sales tax is to all state government revenues, which is trust funds in addition to general revenue. So very equivalent. The Constitution lays out a couple other provisions we're going to talk about in a minute, but it's the fact that it allows them to have ad valorem and it's their single largest revenue source is generally what we want to focus on the most. So this shows you in a snapshot the reliance local governments have on ad valorem. So the top graph is showing you how counties are using ad valorem, and it gives you a distribution about what their percentage of their total revenue collections is made up of their ad valorem collections. So for counties in local fiscal year 2018-19, ad valorem property taxes range from a low of 10.5% of all revenues in McCullough to a high of 47.3% of all revenues in Flagler and everything in between. So the average was about 24% of total revenues come from ad valorem across the state. And we have about 20 counties are actually cl- clustered right around that 24%. For municipalities, we're still inputting the 18-19 data, so we have to go back a year to local fiscal year 2017-18. The variance among municipalities was even greater. So we had 22 cities that did not levy property taxes at all in that year. We had two cities that pretty much only relied on their property taxes. Those are both in Orange County. And then the average across all 411 incorporated areas of the state was about 14.7% of their total revenues. And we had about 119 municipalities clustered right at that average. So a couple of things, though, to think about. We just said that Wakulla, it was only 10.5%, so very low. Why is that? Well, we're starting to get into it when we look at this slide. For the 18-19 budget year, 14 out of 67 counties and 12 out of the 309 of the reporting entities, there are 390 reporting entities we had, were levying ad valorem taxes very near to or at the maximum millage limitation set by the Constitution. So the Constitution says you can only, if you're a local government that's a county or a local government that is a city, you're limited to 10 mills. So we had those number of local governments are already at that. There's some provisions where you can go beyond that if you have an MSTU or special districts, but for the local government itself, those are the 10 mil cap is in law. We already see some that are very near that maximum cap. And so Wakulla is one of those. So it may be only 10.5% of their total revenues, but they don't have very much further they could go with that. That is, they're basically tapped out. So that's kind of setting up an interesting thing. If you're reaching your millage limitation or approaching your millage limitation, those other revenue sources that we're going to talk about become even more important. But we know some have even limited abilities in those areas. So the ones we focus on the most are those that meet a criteria in law saying that they're a fiscally constrained county. And so there's several criteria. The big one is that the value of 1 mil, it only raises no more than 5 million in your area. So this is the map. That top map that has the pink highlighted is showing you that today the 29 fiscally constrained counties we have, those that are economically challenged, particularly in terms of being challenged on the property tax side. And then on the bottom graph, what I'm showing you, or bottom map of Florida, what I'm showing you is what their per capita revenues were. And so main point I'm making from this, if you look at the yellows and those very light greens, our fiscally constrained counties are lining up with those that tend to have the lowest per capita revenues. So it's not just on the ad valorem side. It's usually they don't have a lot of other economic development growth available to them, which also constrains other kinds of revenues they can raise. So that's not 100% true, but generally speaking, they tend to move together. So what if it's not ad valorem, which the Constitution says directly they can raise, what other kinds of revenues can they raise? Well, the Constitution says or acknowledges that the legislature can directly give them revenues, or we can directly establish revenues that they can use. It can only be the legislature. Can't this part, especially for taxes, cannot be done locally. It has to be done at your level. And so if you look at the list we've provided you, we've just given you all the major sources that people typically think about. These are either imposed by the legislature and shared with the local government, or just shared with the local government. So an example of that, the top three on this list would be, number one is number 12, which is the local government half-cent sales tax program. So we levy it, but then we share what our sales tax collections are with the locals every year. And so this, in terms of importance, it would show up under the intergovernmental revenue category. It's about $1.4 billion for counties and about $831 million for cities. The other two are kind of equally, they just are split on county-city side. Number five, the county revenue sharing program, about $540 million. And number 15, the municipal revenue sharing program, which is just equally important on that side. So of the revenue sources authorized by the legislature, actually the biggest ones are where we're actually collecting it and sharing what we collect with them. The next list is showing you where the legislature is giving them the authority to enact a revenue source, so either through an ordinance or through a referendum. And so I'm giving you the entire list. The one that stands out on this list by far and away would be the local discretionary sales surtaxes, those local option surtaxes we have. That's about $2 billion for counties, about $500 million for cities. It's a collection of different things, but very, very important in terms of the volume of money being shared with them. The next group are the local option taxes, number two, convention development taxes, number 16, the tourist development taxes, number 17, the tourist impact tax. They're about $1.2 billion. So that would be the next important group. The final group, and this kind of circles us back to our first slide. You remember we said that for both cities and counties, charges for services were their most important, collectively, their most important revenue source. Virtually all of those revenue sources are based on their home rule authority. So it doesn't require general law authorization. It's not required to be spelled out in the Constitution. It's inherent in the role of government that they serve under the 1968 Constitution. So their home rule authorities are very expansive in this regard for this set of revenue sources. So there's three classes of what's usually accomplished under this home rule authority for revenue collection. The first is proprietary fees, and you can think of those as admissions fees, the franchise fees, user fees, utility fees. Those are the biggest ones. And the guiding legal principle for this group is that the imposed proprietary fee is reasonable in relation to the government-provided privilege or service, or that the fee payer receives a special benefit that this pays for. The next group is the regulatory fees. They are actually imposed pursuant to the local government's police powers in the exercise of its functioning as a sovereign state or sovereign function. They include building permits fees, impact fees, inspection fees, and stormwater fees. And again, same concept, a regular fee should not exceed the regulated activity's cost and generally required to be applied solely to that purpose. You couldn't divert it for another purpose. And then last is the special assessments. Examples of this includes beach renourishment, restoration, downtown redevelopment, garbage disposal, fire and rescue services, parking facilities, sewer improvements, stormwater. So that cluster, they're usually used to construct and maintain capital facilities and to fund certain services related to them. And this one, is, again, similar thing, there has to be, the they if it's a special assessment, for example, it has to be assessed against a property that has derived the special benefit from the improvement or service. So as an overview, there's three ways that local governments can raise revenue, and we have good data so far on how they've been collecting for 18-19. And we do have a local government financial handbook that's been shared with you and is online on our website. We also have county profiles that contain some revenue information, and we have city profiles, but that's pretty dated at this point. It's census-based material, so it's going back to 2010.
Thank you, Coordinator Baker. Members, we have about 5 minutes for questions. Does anyone have any questions? No, I have one quick question or comment. I think one of the most important things you said is a regulatory fee should not exceed the regulated activity's cost and is generally required to be applied solely to that purpose. Is that something that we could see the fee and then what the cost is, or is that through an audit?
From the data that's available to us at the statewide level, it would be very hard for us to match it up, to map one thing to another. Through an audit, you would have a better feel for that and be able to ask the questions to do a better job of that.
Thank you. Well, seeing no further questions, Coordinator Baker, thank you for joining us today and providing a very interesting introduction to local government revenue sources. Thank you. Well, leading us into the next presentation, she mentioned audits. Members, our next presenter is Matthew Tracy, Deputy Auditor General on behalf of the Auditor General's Office. Deputy AG Tracy will explain the three different types of audits which the Auditor General's Office is called on to perform. Once again, after his presentation, if time allows, I will open the meeting up for discussions and questions. Deputy AG Tracy, you are recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I appreciate the opportunity today to discuss the type of audits performed by the Order Auditor General's Office. Again, my name is Matthew Tracy. I'm the Deputy Auditor General for State Government Audits, and I'm a certified public accountant. Clicker going? You want to know everything about the audits? This is the 30,000-foot view, 10, 15-minute view. The three types of audits our office conducts are financial, operational, and performance audits. I'm briefly going to summarize what type of audits we conduct, what they each provide, and maybe more importantly, sometimes questions come up, well, why didn't your audit answer that? So maybe what an audit won't provide. Before I discuss the type of audits conducted by our office, just a little background information on our office. Our office is the external auditor for the state of Florida, and we're provided for in the state constitution. Section 1142 Florida statutes designates the Auditor General as a constitutional officer, and sections 11.42 through 11.47 set forth her general authority and duties, including the financial, operational, and performance audits our office conducts. So the first type of audits, maybe the ones you may be most familiar with from your local governments, are your financial audits, and we conduct those as well. And pursuant to statute, which is 11.45, a financial audit is an examination of financial statements in order to express an opinion as the fairness of the financial statements in conformity with generally accepted accounting principles. It also includes an examination of whether operations are conducted in accordance with legal and regulatory requirements. State law requires the state itself, the state of Florida, and each local government to obtain an annual financial audit that must be conducted in accordance with government auditing standards issued by the Comptroller General of the United States and auditing standards generally accepted in the United States of America. State law also specifies these audits are to be conducted within 9 months of a fiscal year end. So for your local district school boards, their fiscal year end is June 30th. The deadline to complete those financial audits is coming up at the end of next month. So as you can imagine, we do the majority of school district financial audits. It's a busy time of the year for our school district auditors. This is actually a cover of what we affectionately refer to as the Yellow Book. It is the government auditing standards. Those are the standards by which we conduct all of our financial, operational, and performance audits. Like I said, they're more commonly known as the Yellow Book for their iconic look. It's been that way for decades. The Yellow Book is issued by the Government Accountability Office and includes standards for various engagements, including the financial and performance audits our office conducts. We also conduct our financial audit in accordance with the AICP, or the American Institute of Certified Public Accountants, professional standards. That is the comprehensive source of professional standards and interpretations that is issued by the AICPA. So what do you get out of a financial audit? That's a common question we get whenever we're asked to do different types of engagements. What does a financial audit give you? Well, financial audit first can provide you some comfort over the accuracy of financial information reported by your government. It may reveal systemic financial reporting errors throughout a year, but most importantly, it can be critical. A well-done financial statement audit can be critical to enhancing decision-making for the government that places reliance on the accuracy and completeness of the financial data. Put simply, what a financial audit is designed to do is to tell you whether the amounts reported by a government on its financial statements are accurately reported. As part of making this determination, the auditor is to report any non-compliance with applicable requirements, though the audit is not designed to do this, to find all non-compliance. And while, as an auditor, we do consider internal control relevant to the preparation and fair presentation of the financial statements, we don't issue an opinion on internal control. Our sole objective with the financial statement audit is to say, are those numbers, as reported by the government, correct? So here's a little example just to make it pretty simple, hopefully. A government reports spending $100 million on a benefits program. A financial audit would be simply designed to determine whether the government accurately reported the expenditure of those $100 million. A financial audit would not be designed to assess whether the government should have spent $100 million or whether they spent that $100 million on eligible persons. It would simply say whether the government accurately reported the expenditure of those $100 million. The issues about whether the $100 million should have been spent or were spent on ineligible persons would be addressed in like an operational type audit. All audits have caveats, financial audits included. In sum, like I said, the primary objective of a financial audit is to issue an opinion indicating whether the financial statements include information that is materially correct. While we consider internal control and compliance, the purpose of our audit is to not identify all deficiency in internal control and non-compliance. It's strictly to consider those matters in relationship to making that opinion about the correctness of the financial statement numbers. Getting to the second type of audits our office conducts, which are operational audits. On the slide before you is the definition, but really in short, an operational audit evaluates internal controls, including those controls established by management to promote compliance, economic and efficient operations, reliable records or reports, and safeguarding assets. We routinely perform operational audits of a variety of entities, state agencies, state colleges and universities, water management districts, district school boards. For example, we are required to audit every state agency at least once every 3 years. So like the Florida Department of Veterans Affairs, your committee has purview over, we're in there at least once every 3 years auditing them. Operational audits must be conducted in accordance with government auditing standards, the Yellow Book I showed you earlier. And the focus of those audits is on internal controls and on compliance. So while financial audits focus on whether the numbers reported in the financial statements are fairly presented, an operational audit will look at whether the internal controls established by management promote compliance with applicable laws and other requirements, foster efficient and effective operations, produce reliable records and reports, and safeguard assets. So your typical operational audit findings will include things such as absent or poorly designed controls that may permit the ineffective or inefficient administration of a government program. So going back to my earlier example, the financial audit tells you that the government accurately reported spending $100 million. But you want to know, was it spent on all eligible persons? That's where an operational audit would come in and assess, were those dollars spent on persons who were eligible for that program? Last but not least, our office conducts a limited number of performance audits. That's an example. Coordinator Baker mentioned the ad valorem laws just a bit ago. Our office is required to conduct a performance audit of the Department of Revenue's administration of the ad valorem property tax laws at least once every 3 years. The statute actually gets into some specifics about what a performance audit is. It's to be an examination of a governmental entity, program, activity, or function. And then it actually lists out a number of things that the audit is to consider. Things like the economy and efficiency of the program, the structure of the design of the program to accomplish its goals and objectives, perhaps alternative ways that you can provide those program services or products to the way it's being currently provided. The performance audit may also look at the performance measures used by the government program to report and monitor program performance. Similar to an operational audit type audit, there's a lot of crossover between a performance and an operational audit. We will assess compliance with the program with appropriate policies, laws, and rules, and perhaps any other issues that the Legislative Auditing Committee may direct us when we're conducting a performance audit. You'll see a common theme here. It all ties back to our government auditing standards. Our performance audits are also conducted in accordance with government auditing standards. And both performance and operational audits look at internal controls and look for compliance. So they're very similar, but so what's the difference between the two? Well, the primary difference is that the objectives of performance audit. The performance audit objectives tend to be broader and tend to look at things like, is the government program that we're auditing or that is being audited appropriately designed to accomplish its goals and objectives? Are there alternative means of providing the program services or products? Is there a different way to do this? The government's administering the program this way, but is there a different way that the program could be done in a more efficient and effective manner? So, going back to my government benefits program example, the financial audit told you that the government said it spent $100 million. It put it on its financial statements as $100 million. It was accurate and complete. Whether they should have spent $100 million, whether they spent it on the right persons, that's where the operational audit will come in and say, was that $100 million spent on eligible persons? But a performance audit could then ask additional questions like, well, can this program be done in a different way? Do we have to do it this way? Is it best structured to accomplish whatever the goals or objectives of that government program are? So like with financial audits, there's caveats to operational performance audits. And really, this is endemic to any audit we conduct. By its nature, an audit can't include a review of all activities and transactions that a government undertakes. Do a lot of sampling. We try to detect noncompliance. We try to detect patterns of internal control deficiencies. But because you can't be looking at everything at every time, an audit cannot be relied upon to identify all instances of noncompliance, fraud, abuse, waste, or inefficiency. Although we definitely try our best. So I went through that pretty quickly with the 30,000 feet view. But if you have any questions regarding the types of audits our office conducts, please let us know. Also, our website is on that last slide. It's floridaauditor.gov. If you have any interest in our audit reports on state government entities, local government entities, district school boards, water management districts, they're available at our website. And certainly, if you have any questions, feel free to reach out to our office. So thank you for your time today.
Thank you, Deputy AG Tracy. And members will now go into questions. I do have a couple questions for you. Yeah. Are performance audits done automatically or do they have to be requested?
Thank you, Chair.
Recognized.
They usually are. If there are two performance audits that are statutorily set, one is of the ad valorem tax laws and one is of a local government performance reporting system. Otherwise, normally we would be directed to do a performance audit. Years back, the legislature directed us to do a performance audit of the state's early learning programs and early learning coalitions, delivery of school readiness and BPPA programs. That was specifically directed as a performance audit because they wanted to know, was the state delivering early learning program services in the most efficient and effective manner to accomplish the program goals? So, but that is normally directed.
Thank you. And my other question is on operational audits. Would they reveal whether a competitive bid process was conducted in order for a contract to be awarded?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, we hopefully, if we're doing our job right, if we're digging into the records, contracts is usually a fruitful area, state contracting activities. We would pull all the bid records or ask for the bid records, hopefully they're in existence, and then evaluate them for compliance with statute. So that's a very common area, given the level of contracting that the state does with entities, that we do review compliance with statutory requirements when agencies contract.
Thank you. Members, are there any additional questions? Yes, Rep. Salzman, you're recognized.
Good afternoon. The email address that you have listed, it bounces. Is there a way to contact your office?
My email address? The Matthew Tracy?
Yes. I've been trying to email you.
Oh, well, I apologize that I have actually been having email issues, so I will make sure that I get back with you and my IT folks to see why I haven't been receiving your emails. I trust you that it's certainly nothing personal because my email address looks correct. But like I said, coincidentally, my send box disappeared yesterday. All my items went away, so I don't know if that was a...
I have the bounce back messages if you need them, but...
Okay.
Anytime is fine. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Woodson, you're recognized for a question.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, sir, for such a thorough presentation. Who audits the Auditor General Office of Florida? Thank you also for ensuring that, you know, we have the check and balance system in place. But do you get audited by any agency, or what type of relationship do you have with OPAGA, since they do the research and all those different types of services for the state of Florida as well? Do you all work jointly, or do you have any relationship with them and the work that you do?
Madam Chair, that's a good question. It's funny, on our website, there is a section of it, who audits the auditors. And in fact, we do get audited once every 3 years. A team of auditors from around the country come in and do a peer review of our work, where they go through our work papers to make sure that we're complying with relevant standards. Our most recent peer review was done in 2019, and we received a clean opinion, the highest level that we could get, and we take quite a lot of pride in that. Our office, we hope, has a great reputation, not only with the legislature, with national auditors all across this country. With respect to OPAGA, we actually share the same building across the street with the Pepper Building. Years ago, they used to be a part of us, and we still maintain a close working relationship with them. Their management, our management, frequently converse about projects that maybe OPAGA is working on, that we're working on to avoid duplication efforts, or where we maybe can work on things in a mutually beneficial manner. We do that with the Department of the Lottery. We do the Department of the Lottery's financial statement audit. OPAGA looks at their revenue generating. So we sort of work on the same sort of engagement in discussing and working together. So we do have a good relationship with OPAGA. And look forward to any opportunities that we have with them.
Thank you. Any other questions? Representative Daly, you're recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and Deputy AG Tracy. Thank you so much for the presentation and for explaining to us how it all works. Because I think we can all agree that there's nothing more important than making sure our state agencies and entities are operating the best way that they can. I do have one question. As a proud Florida State Seminole, can we audit your mask?
You do not have to answer that question. I'm kidding.
It has already been audited by your fine staff director and stuff, and by
approved.
My boss, and by my boss, who is a proud Florida State alum. So, thank you.
Thank you. We have a couple other questions. Representative Sabatini, you're recognized. Never mind. Okay. Representative Joseph, you're recognized.
Is it possible to do a performance audit of the FSU football team?
Representative Joseph, you are recognized.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Quick question about the Florida lottery audits. It's my understanding that in the past there have sometimes been issues with figuring out a way to audit usage specifically for media markets that may not have traditional rating scores. My question for you, and you don't have to answer it right now today, but if you could get back to my office, that would be great. What are the criteria or standard practices that can be used for like smaller minority businesses
And they may not be minority, they just might be smaller and smaller markets that aren't using the traditional ratings and scoring. That's it.
Thank you, Representative Joseph. And yes, I'd like to circle back with your office to make sure I give you the best information, get in contact with my manager responsible for the lottery audits, and we'll be in touch with that information.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you. Seeing no further questions, Deputy AG Tracy, thank you for joining us today and explaining the different approaches your office may take to examine the procedures and actions taken by local governments.
Thank you.
And thank you, members, for your attention. Once we adjourn, please remember to exit promptly so the sergeant staff can prepare the room. And with that, Representative DeSigley moves, we rise, and without objection, the meeting is adjourned.